Hi and welcome. You are listening to The Philosophists, a pair of software guys, but we won't be doing that all our lives. No, we have our eyes on the bigger prize, to be professional philosophers. We can't wait for the money to roll in and the fame, but in the meantime, we will settle for injecting a little bit of philosophy into your everyday. This week's topic is whether you should feel bad about doing good and how you should approach the question of whether you should do more. My name is Declan McGrath, seeking altruism in all the wrong places.
And my name is Simon Robertson, and I'll be playing a devil's advocate until the devil himself turns up.
Okay, let's get philosophistical. One thing that's occurred to me lately is that I think the Cosmic Skeptic did a podcast on altruism and how one should think about altruism, and should we feel bad about not selling all our possessions? I think that's basically how he framed it. And I'm kind of asking the question, should we sell all our possessions? Should we give all our money, you know, as much of it as possible to charity or not? And people that would say that the conclusion is, well, we shouldn't feel too bad about the fact that we don't give, you know, make these monumental efforts to give all, you know, our wealth away as quickly as possible to help people. Anyone that says that we shouldn't feel bad about that, I kind of disagree a bit with that position, in that we ought to do more. I think each of us ought to do more, but it's like a lot of things. There's just social norms in place that your neighbor doesn't happen to give more, and your neighbor on the other side doesn't happen to give more. And we end up in a situation where the social norm is not really to do charity as a otherwise wealthy enough society. And my feeling would be that we should do. And there's a couple of caveats to that, but I'm not sure what your thinking on that is.
Well, so I do agree with you in the sense that I think a social norm isn't going to really provide much kind of truth value in an evaluation of any kind of moral judgment. Just because other people do X does not make X right, would be my pretty trivial, unthought of, like, in-depth counter. But the one thing I would actually say is, like, okay, if you start looking at, we are going to look to donate more of our money to charity. So, okay, you say, I'm going to donate 10% of my paycheck, and then, yeah, I'm going to buy a coffee. It's like, well, really, that coffee money should also go to the charity, arguably, because it's going to do something more than just give you a slight bit of pleasure. It could save a life. But I would actually, if you think about the actions you take and the impacts they have, there would be an argument I would make that, like, you'd have to figure out where the end of your, like, the ripple of your actions ends. And so for me, it's like, okay, say I cut out, or everyone cut out, say, going to the theater. So all of a sudden, there's a large number of people who are unemployed, and there's a large number of buildings that go derelict, and, you know, potentially other bits and pieces that go along with that. And then you could say the same with eating in restaurants, and the same with, you know, a huge number of other things. And I think I'm getting to the point, it's like, I don't think you could have, like, a, I don't want to say a charity-based economy, but I think that the actual impact of, like, following that through to the extreme would end up with, like, more people in almost, like, dangerous levels of poverty. It's almost like you'd have to prop up the economy by buying things to stop people starving.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a fair point. If you keep going the whole way along that line of reasoning, it looks like, at the moment, on the surface of it, it looks, well, how could the economy function at all? But then the thing is, the way the economy functions anyway, most of the work, most of the wealth generated is generated off the back of kind of derivative investments. And most of the money that flows around economies generally is considered somewhat non-productive. So I think, like, the way economies tend to be oriented at the moment aren't particularly productive anyway. So we're already onto a losing battle in terms of making progress, because a lot of the work that goes in that people do each day is just hemorrhaged in terms of benefits to the world or to society. So I think that it would be part of a bigger picture. It wouldn't just be personally that one person should give more. It would be, there would have to be an element of the, you know, that this, you wouldn't, we would end up moving into kind of systematic territory there. But I think we can avoid getting bogged down in that if we just said we took the example of the amount of people that start doing this is not so much that it brings down these industries. Maybe that would keep us out of that loophole. And we could say, well, okay, a small but growing number of individuals over time, so there's no shock effects to theaters and whatnot, just choose to divert more of their money incrementally each time to good causes. That would avoid the shock effect, I think. And it would still leave us in the position of saying, why don't we give 1% more each every year for the next whatever number of years? Now, there has to be a limit on that. But
there's an interesting point there where you're looking at morals on like a social scale. Because the whole point is like, how are you going to dictate your actions? Surely you should do morally good actions. And what you're saying is like, oh, actually, you are deliberately doing immoral actions, possibly strongly wording it there, but only to allow others to do moral actions. And I feel that's a very dangerous precedent if you start saying that I'm going to be immoral to allow other people to be moral. So it's like, I will start fires to provide the firemen with work to do. Like, it's almost on that level of like, you don't want to start as a moral model, having this distinction of saying an individual can't evaluate their actions.
Which is the bit that is the immoral action, just to...
essentially it's the not giving your money to charity in this case.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be advocating not giving your money to charity. I'd be advocating for the individual who takes the, let's call it the moral high ground, the more moral position, to give more money to charity, that person would be doing that. But are you saying that a requirement of this way to make progress is that other people don't at the same time carry out the same moral actions, and you're...
Yeah, so that was your model, right? It's just to prevent the shockwave effect. It's like, but in which case dictating in society, like some people are essentially acting more morally than others in their individual actions, and you're saying that is okay, which I would worry about if you're going to make that your ethical moral model.
I think it depends on what the word okay means. There are okay is kind of a proxy for better or good or other, you know, it's saying that, well, that maybe equating okay to better or good is just confusing. But I think it's more, not so much okay, but it's more just pragmatic, and that we know that the world en masse won't switch to everyone being altruistic overnight. And even if people did, we can't calculate whether that would necessarily be a bad thing, which itself sounds paradoxical. I think it is part of the model is that, yeah, if we could all navigate in the same direction, and we could actually look around and say, we're all going to take this action, and we could coordinate doing better together, that would set us up for a different way of making progress. But the one thing that we know about, you know, our species is that we're not great at coordinating in the way we would like to at the moment in order to make moral progress. So you know, it's not so much a requirement that other people don't join in doing better, but it is just a pragmatic factor that we know.
Okay. So along the same lines, my next point would be, it's like, we'd have to have a way of identifying, I think it's be a slippery slope argument of like, at what point have you donated enough? So say we all agree, like, we're going to do this 1% increment as a society over the next like 1,000 years. So there's going to be a point, it's like, well, obviously you can't over 1,000 years of reducing by 1%, you're going to be living on, you know, the below the poverty line. And I actually do question how much society could persist in a meaningful way if you reduce your spending that much. That's obviously like a big unknown, like we would be able to say one way or the other. But yeah, I would expect there's the two problems of like, could the society persist? I will grant you that it could, and like you could still be, but like you would still have to have this point where you're saying, okay, we've done enough. And I don't mean like enough in terms of like as like we are stopping this action, but you've transformed enough, because as soon as you have any expendable component, then it seems that you could give that away. And that seems like that would be, I think anyone reasonable would say that's gone too far. But the logic would still persist, because any individual action you take versus, say, someone dying, it feels like you should save the person dying.
Yeah, there's two questions in there. I think the first one is, how do you ensure you have enough left for yourself, even personally? Like, if you give all your money away. And it, let's say down the road, if that was 80% of your income each year, you'd be left with 20%. Well, would that be enough for your retirement when you wouldn't have income necessarily coming in? So how would you ensure that you've enough? And I think that question itself actually gets to the heart of it. But with the 1% each year, absolutely, that would go up above 100%, and that would be impossible. It was more just a general sense of increasing up until a point where we've reached an equilibrium that we'd keep going towards that. Now, I think the other point is just on could the world survive and could economy survive? And I think what we're kind of facing anyway is that there simply won't be jobs anyway. Like, I simply don't think that the way the world is right now is sustainable. And it just seems kind of obvious from the rise in populism and discontent, you know, across many countries, that the economic system doesn't work as well as it needs to, maybe as back in the 70s and 80s for people in different countries. So I don't think there's a solution to that. I don't think you can just retrain a whole bunch of people from an automotive industry as all being software developers overnight.
Well, just to add to that point, if we did go down this road of intense charity, it's not even a case of like, oh, we can retrain these people to do these other jobs, because so many of those jobs just won't exist.
Yeah, like they won't exist anyway, is my thinking. Like, and I think that's more of a political question, and it's probably less fruitful to go down that. That was what I was just going to say.
Oh, sorry.
I would be probably looking at basically how do we get the robots to do most of the work and generate whatever goods are needed, and then how do we navigate the space on top of that we can politically dish out money, you know, to each other in a way that we don't annihilate each other. I think that's a separate, that would get us away from the charity altruistic thing. And
if we can get to the Star Trek economy, that would be the dream. Everyone works for free and everything's provided for you. That would be ideal.
I think that's maybe something we could talk about, you know, maybe another time. But for in terms of the charity aspect, I think your question was, how do you know when is enough? You know, where do you find the balance? And I think that's the right question, because, you know, even if you don't have a lot of dependence on you, like most people have a certain level of dependence once they hit a certain age. It might be, you know, kids, it could be parents, it could be other people in their lives, people they're caring for, animals, other things like that people have that cause outgoings and that, you know, where people's survival or at least welfare largely depends on you. And once you have that kind of level of responsibility, it all of a sudden becomes a question of how much is not just enough for me, but how much is it enough for all the small, the close network of people that actually directly depend on me before we start talking about charity per se. And I think that's the whole crux of the issue, is the fact that we can't, as individuals, we have to provide for many other people in lots of cases. And it's that calculus, it's that gamble that puts us off giving more. I think people would be much happier to give more if they knew that, you know, it wasn't necessary to hoard as much, you know, right till you draw your last breath, both yours and other people.
So
that's a hard one to call.
on your list of dependents, actually, I would add also like future you.
Yes.
As like there's very much the sense you have that safety net, or you have things for later enjoyment. You don't buy everything for your immediate consumption or enjoyment. And then the other, with that dependence argument, it's actually would go into a potentially controversial area where you might say, well, should you have children? They are a huge cost. And it's like, should you have a child versus saving a life? Again, it feels that like there's, you know, the social norm might be different here, but like the moral, ethically good thing to do would seem to be saving the life or like stopping the suffering. And that's where, again, like if you start putting your actions into this extreme case of should I do X or save a life, I think you're going to get into many very uncomfortable situations where it's clear it's almost like a form of extremism.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that it's extremism or fundamentalism. I think it depends what we call extreme, and this gets meta-philosophical, but extreme would seem to me to be you take a position that's highly contrary to, you know, what would be the right thing to do. You know, if something is evidently the right thing to do, I don't think that position could be called extreme. It might strongly violate social norms. I suppose it's extreme in the sense of social norms and what's acceptable discourse politically and within society. So yes, I'll come around and not argue over the meaning of the word extreme.
But I'll take one point. I agree with you. You can't say they're doing essentially the right thing. You have to define these terms a bit better, but isn't an extreme position to hold. But I think it is extreme to say everything I ever do is evaluated in this very specific way. Because, for example, if someone goes,
what is that specific way? Sorry, as in
to judge it against this moral standard.
Yeah.
So, if you take things up a little bit more trivial, it's like if you have someone who watches what they eat, you know, they every choice they make about eating in a dietary sense, you would just say, "Oh, that's the correct decision." But if you look at their life and how they structure what they eat, you could potentially say they've got an extreme opinion on food in the sense that they only do things based on this evaluation of, is it better for me than an alternative? So I'd say it's not the individual choices that would make you extreme. It's the framework that you're using is the extreme framework. If that makes sense. I'm not sure if I made that distinction clear.
Yeah. Let's just wrap it up and I'll come back to the what I was saying, where I was going to go. No, totally. No, let's just clear up on this one here. You're saying an individual, let's say, they decide I'm going to, whatever it is they eat, they might eat fast food once a week, right? Or let's say twice a week, okay? And then we're saying, oh, well, maybe you should only have it once a week or not at all. And we're morally judging them in that respect because it'll be better for you. You might live a bit longer. You might live better quality of life longer. And we're judging you in each micro moment, every single moment, in terms of what you did eat or what you didn't eat. And that level of micromanagement or micro judgment of a diet, one's diet, is extreme. My only question, because I didn't quite get it, is it's extreme in what sense? Other than it seems a bit weird to judge someone heavily like that. But what's the extreme bit to that judgment?
I suppose it would be the evaluation of every action is just an extreme to me. Is an extreme process.
Yeah, so there's a statistical model, like some actions will give you better bang for your buck and other actions won't. You know, maybe the coffee one won't make a difference as much as something else you spend a lot of money on. By comparison, let's say you get lunch and it's 10 euro or $10 a day and the coffee is $2 or €3, whatever it is. You get better bang for your buck the higher you go up the value chain. So we then only talk about those actions that make, like, there's only a certain amount of time to talk about things and judge people. We're running out of time to judge people. But that's kind of the way the world works, right? So we judge people on the bigger ticket items rather than the smaller ticket items. But that, again, that seems to be a pragmatic concern broader than extreme. Like, if we took like AI and big data and how, let's say, what's reported, how certain countries are building their models of what makes a good citizen, for example, I think that was reportedly happening in China, they're rolling out a system. It does in fact seem that those micro actions are being judged increasingly so, where cameras are picking up what people are doing, even smaller transactions are getting picked up and judged, and a citizen score would appear to be kind of calculated based on that, which would determine your access to maybe credit and other utilities in society and preferences in society. It seems like that's the way the world will go. And it's happening with, you know, how we're tracking data generally at a global scale. I think we're headed towards that extreme micro judgment, though it's not necessarily a philosopher at the moment or societal person doing it. It's a corporate or maybe governmental actor.
I mean, there's definitely value in big data and you can make certain correlations and get inferred information as well from how people act. But I think I suppose it would be the case of saying, like, do you actually think there is truly such a thing as a trivial choice? I mean, obviously, like, we have to assume, like, free will and a bunch of other stuff here, right? But if you had a trivial choice, you would have to evaluate that choice still, even though you might be saying, okay, the difference, there is no difference in output at this point. You still have to do the evaluation if you're evaluating every decision you're making to say, is this actually a trivial choice, which has no impact on moral worth in the world going forward?
Yeah, I think that's where, like, it's like any sort of rule-based system versus a kind of a virtue-based system gets traded off. In a virtue-based system, my understanding is that we kind of just say, well, this is broadly what good looks like. These are good examples or sort of good behaviors. This is how we should do it without specifying in detail, which, you know, a deontological Kantian kind of ethics would have hard rules that... Mm. That you know, we keep writing rules until we're done, which is just quite hard in the real world. Are an utilitarian, we can't really do it in advance. We would like to be able to do that statistical calculation of the exact benefit that would come out. We try to guess at that each time. And virtue ethics then kind of is maybe a little bit making a little bit of a comeback in certain areas, or at least it's making a comeback to arrive at the table after being ignored for quite a while. And just because it's so difficult to say exactly what is right, but it does seem easier to say generally what is right. Now, easier doesn't mean easy, but that was kind of my thinking on just around those micro decisions. I mean, I think you're right in that it's hard to calculate the butterfly effect and kind of scale that out. So it will be difficult for these systems, these kind of all-encompassing surveillance systems and micro tracking systems to come up with a good answer, you know, an answer of what is good and what is right. And often it'll make cases that are the neural networks or whatever they're trained on, they're just biased in the wrong direction. You won't get good out of it, you'll get bad. But what it might do, might circle back to where what we were talking on earlier on was, you know, just, it was interesting what you brought up around, should you bring new humans along into the world or should you not? And maybe claiming that could be controversial territory, and certainly is. We won't get bogged down the word extreme because it doesn't really matter. It's just the question is really, should that be something we're thinking about when we're talking about making the world a better place, making progress in the world? And it seems obvious that if you were to pick a dog up tomorrow, that people would generally say you're better off going to a pound. If you wanted to just, you know, rescue dogs and do what's good for dogs, it makes more sense to go to a pound and get a dog from the dog pound than it does to get a highly bred dog, which we all know the breeding industries, you know, there can be a fallout rate, you know, of suffering that arises from that. So if it makes sense in an animal example like that to go and save the dog that exists, and it seems evidently clear that the more moral thing, feel free to dispute this, is to get the animal that needs rescuing from the pound rather than breeding a new animal. Why is it that different for humans where the stakes are even higher?
So my counter to that example would be something along the lines of, and it'd actually be similar to my previous example, previous argument about who would you pick to be the people who make the sacrifice first? If you make this moral judgment, say, okay, is it better to save someone or have a baby? It's better to save someone. That kind of would mean, and again, this is kind of a just more of a thought experiment, but it's like no one would have children until everyone was saved. Yeah. And there's obviously a problem in society at that point of whilst there is suffering, there are no children being born. And then at some point, that's a problem.
So what's the problem there, that humanity will die out?
Essentially, yes. Like,
yeah.
If you want to reduce suffering, I suppose removing humanity would be one way of doing it, but probably not the one that people would prefer. And you'd have the same problem of saying, okay, which people get to have kids, essentially, because they're the ones who are acting, again, immorally. But you need to be immoral in this case to persist the survival of the species, which seems like, I don't know, it seems like a good thing to do.
Yeah. So, well, I think it's David Benatar has a book on Better Never to Be Born. And he argues the case that it is always better not to be born. It's never in anyone's interests to be born overall. And he sets out arguments for that. And he, uses different ways of doing it. And I've not read the book, but I've just heard that some of the summary analysis on it. And some of his arguments are very convincing. I think David Pearce, he's another philosopher who does a lot of work in this area and in what's called Humanity Plus, I think he calls it now, but it's the kind of transhumanist movement to kind of using technology to improve life. And he does seem to agree with David Benatar on the better never to have been born, in his opinion. But he uses the phrase to say that the future belongs to life lovers, not the opposite, and that evolution will kick in, that antinatalists simply cannot reproduce sufficiently enough that they can overcome the pronatalists. So you have an evolutionary problem where you're going to get blocked as an antinatalist movement long before the whole population.
Well, I mean, I will concede at this point that I'm doing the thought experiment of everyone rational, morally rational beings. Mm. And, you know, I suppose you could start arguing kind of game theory type evaluations of how things would work. But
yeah, again, it's kind of controversial in that, yeah, I think that it does make sense that we do think, you know, more constructively about population sizes. Like, we're on this petri dish of a planet together, and we're starting to push against the edges of each other always more, you know, more strongly. And this brings in resourcing issues, it brings in poverty generally. You can rescue, we had 4 billion people on the planet, whatever it was, let's say 20 years ago or thereabouts, that's a rough estimate. Now we have double that. I mean, if you bring the first 4 billion out of poverty, you're going to struggle to stem that flow if you're adding another 4 billion. And it tends to be the extra 4 billion is not the affluent end. So even if we'd solved 4 billion, if we'd solved everything that was there 20 years ago, we would have the exact same problem or bigger all over again now. Yeah. So it does seem like we need to reorient away from always increasing. And there is some natural effects of that happening in the West with the 2.4 children or whatever it's at now. But again, it's one of those things where it does seem to be that it makes sense to give more. And the dial we're trying to nudge is, how do you curb the number of dependents that you have relying on you? Or at least make it so that they're not dependents anymore, that we can actually provide safety nets, that you don't have as many dependents because they don't depend on you, because actually society itself is already better. And then that frees you up to do better. And it creates a virtuous cycle in that respect.
I totally agree. Just in the practical sense, from what you said there, it's like, you know, giving more would seem to be a better choice. Like, it's very hard to argue against that. It's just when you play the game of taking it logically as far as it will go, then you might come into some problems. But I think it's hard to argue that, oh, you should be doing this, you should be giving more, you should be considering these things, at least in passing.
Okay. So if you've made it this far, you've made it to the epilogue. Congratulations. Epilogue's one of those words where you kind of sometimes, if you're not an avid reader, you wonder, what's an epilogue for anyway? Why is it not just the end? But here's where myself and Simon, we just sit down and apologize for anything we've said wrong, or go over past mistakes or clarify things after we've had time to double check the facts and things like that. To wrap up, there's just a few things, you know, a couple of caveats in that maybe that we'll add to that discussion we had. I mentioned David Pearce midway through the episode. I brought him up because I said that something along the lines of antinatalists won't really be able to triumph over evolution because they'll die out before they get a chance to propagate their antinatalist ideas to the children that they will never have. And people who are going to have children, the natalists, their ideas would propagate into the next generation. So ultimately, the idea of antinatalism would die out. And I did say that this was sort of the mainstream opinion within the kind of antinatalist group. However, by good fortune, I was speaking to David after we recorded this episode, and he's not only an intellectual giant, but also a really nice person, and kindly pointed out that not all antinatalists would agree with this point. And as evidence of that, he pointed to some of the responses to a Quora post, which itself was about arguments against antinatalism that he kicked off. So I think the comment section there does indeed show that there's a bit of dissent on that point. And the post is actually a great read. So certainly if you're new to the whole concept of maybe antinatalism and the ideas around it and the criticisms, we'll probably add that in the show notes.
Yeah, and just after having such a discussion about charity and altruism, we thought it'd be a good idea to try and do something. The best bang for your buck seems to be the fight against malaria. So it's againstmalaria.com/thephilosophists, and that will help provide malaria nets for people in the world.
Yeah, and it does seem to be something that is, as you said, good bang for your buck. If you look at effective altruism movements, which we might talk about sometime, some sites out there, they do rank and do a lot of research on what is the best, most effective way to make your dollars, your euros go places. I think Peter Singer did a lot of work around this, the famous philosopher in his own right. Sites like his one, he's got thelifeyoucansave.org, and I think as well givewell.org. They're two sites that rank these different sites. And there was a couple of things about againstmalaria.com that kind of made it stand out, but it's also quite easy to donate no matter where you are in the world and make sure that your donation can be tax claimable. So againstmalaria.com/thephilosophists.
Will that link be in the show notes?
That link will be in the show notes. The
good
show notes will be stuffed with links. I suppose while you're checking out links and show notes and things like that, please at least consider subscribing to the podcast. It may even inspire us to do another episode, and then we can quit declaring victory as having produced a series, I suppose, if we get up to 2 episodes. So you should be able to subscribe in your podcasting app, however you like to do it. Hit some sort of subscribe button. And you can also follow the show on Twitter @philosophistpod. That will be in the show notes, because that's a tricky mouthful otherwise.
Okay, so that's it for episode 1. Hopefully see you again next time. And until then, stay philosophical.
Philosophical.
Okay.